Funding for the Think Podcast comes from TCU, where researchers strive to develop sustainable solutions to protect the world's fresh water supply. You can learn more at endeavors.tcu.edu. Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd, and she'll be back tomorrow. It comes disguised as an invoice. A standard email attachment that looks like a Word document. Once you open it, there's no turning back. You've been trapped by Locky or some other ransomware that's snuck its way into your computer, infected it, and is holding your data, your emails, your documents, all of it, hostage. It might not have happened to you yet, but it might have happened to your bank, your university, your company, even your hospital. And cybercriminals' techniques are quickly morphing. Here to walk us through their world is Josephine Wolf. She's author of an article in The Atlantic called The New Economics of Cybercrime, and she's also assistant professor of public policy and computing security at Rochester Institute of Technology and a faculty associate at the Harvard Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Josephine, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
So can we just dive backwards to the beginning of ransomware? When did it all begin?
So the idea of encrypting somebody else's data is actually pretty old, in computer years at least. It goes back 30 years or so when somebody actually started making the first programs that would infect your computer and encrypt all the data so that you couldn't get access to any of it in clear text. But nobody really used it because there was no way to make money off of it until we had this anonymous system of cryptocurrencies. So nobody was really that interested except as a practical joke, an evil practical joke, but it wasn't really a business.
So when did it become a business? Are you referring to things like Bitcoin or other currencies there?
Exactly. So with the rise of Bitcoin, with the ability for people to make pretty much untraceable financial transactions online, it became a much, much more enticing form of crime. And it helps that that sort of coincided with law enforcement getting much better at cracking down on the more traditional forms of cybercrime around stealing payment card numbers and committing payment card fraud with them.
Okay, so the old model is where the criminals would steal the credit card data and then they would do what with it? They'd sell it to other criminals.
So they'd sell it to other criminals, right? If you go back 10 years and you think about something like the TJ Maxx breach in 2006, 2007, you have criminals led by Albert Gonzalez stealing almost 100 million payment card numbers. And then they take those numbers and they sell them to a guy in Turkey who sells them on to the folks who are going to manufacture fraudulent credit cards. Mm. And when they actually go through and round up all the criminals, which they succeed in doing in that case, they're spread all over the world. There are several different links in this chain, which is really helpful for law enforcement, because once they arrest one of the people involved in one step of this process, they can slowly trace back to the folks who stole the card numbers from TJ Maxx in the first place. So following that money trail was hugely important for trying to catch these criminals, even though they're spread all over the world and it involves passing through a number of different jurisdictions.
So Albert Gonzalez was caught, right? And where is he now?
Yes, he was. He's in prison now.
And so if he were around today, I guess, and he were in cybercrime, what might he do instead of hacking into the servers of TJX and getting those credit card numbers?
Well, who knows what he'd be doing if he were out of prison. And it's worth saying he may yet do it, I suppose. He's been caught before. But one of the new models that we're seeing become very profitable is either what we usually call ransomware, where you infect people's computers at huge scale. You use these large-scale botnets to deliver emails or malicious websites that infect your computer. And once your computer is infected, or once you click on that attachment or that link in an email, then all of your data is encrypted with a key that you don't have, so you can't decrypt it. And the only thing you can do on your computer usually is submit a Bitcoin payment to the criminals. And they say, once we receive this, we will give you the key. You'll be able to decrypt all of your data. Of course, the only way to know if they're telling you the truth is to make the payment and find out.
And this has been happening over and over again in the past. I mean, really, is it just the past few years or year that this is these massive scale attacks, ransomware attacks?
It's really gained steam in the past 2 to 3 years, I would say. And one of the things that we've seen, which is pretty astonishing, is that in the past year or two, it's really not just been individuals either. It's not just you and me sitting at home on our laptops. There have been whole large organizations, police departments, hospitals, banks that have been falling victim to this, at which point you can imagine the price you can charge starts going up pretty rapidly, because what I'm willing to pay for my data is nothing compared to what a bank or a hospital is willing to pay.
And in February of this year, exactly what you're describing, something happened in Hollywood with a hospital. Let's listen to a news report.
A cyber attack has reportedly been launched against the Hollywood Presbyterian Medical Center, causing the entire facility to go into an internal emergency lockdown. The attack has reportedly meant that patient access to files has been severely limited, meaning that there's no access to CT scans, x-rays, lab results. Reportedly, Joe, the hospital is being held to ransom for $3.6 million, or 9,000 Bitcoin.
So, Josephine, how did that Hollywood hospital end up handling the ransomware attack?
So that's actually a really fascinating story, because they did a couple things that were sort of surprising. First thing they did was they reverted to paper charts. Mm. They said, you know, we don't have $3.6 million or however much it was to pay for this. We need to be able to keep seeing patients. They diverted some of them to other hospitals in the area, but they actually kept running basically on the analog systems of 20 or 30 years ago. And the fact that they were able to do that in a lot of ways strengthened their bargaining position. So they basically went back to the attackers and they bargained them down. They did end up paying a ransom, but I think it was something close to $17,000 that they actually paid in the end to restore their systems. And I think a big part of the reason that they were able to get that number lowered so much is, first of all, of course, the criminals want to make money. They don't want to ask you for an amount of money you're not going to pay, because then they lose out as well. But also because they'd sort of demonstrated that they were capable of continuing to function, that the attackers had clearly hurt them significantly, but had not completely shut them down, did not have them sort of out on the streets unable to do anything.
Hmm. So what does a bargain look like? When you say they bargained them down, I mean, this can't be like a traditional bargaining process.
You know, it's more traditional than you might think, because Well, I don't know if it's traditional, but there are a lot of components of this business that you would recognize from completely lawful businesses. So, for example, a lot of people struggle with what it means to even get bitcoins, right? If I say to you, you have to pay this in bitcoins,
yes,
you can't put this on your credit card, because then the police can track who it's going to, and criminals don't want that. So, first of all, that's a huge obstacle for a lot of places. You know, see police departments even who are infected struggling to figure out, what does this mean? How do I get bitcoins, even if I want to pay this ransom? And so the criminal endeavors, which are quite organized and quite large in many cases, set up these basically phone banks where you can call and get customer support for ransomware. And so there are ways of communicating with these people. You can call them up. You can say, you know, I need help. I don't want to pay this much. I want to pay less. And there are actually people at the other end of this who you can sometimes negotiate with, who you can ask for, say, an extension of time. Often there's a clock on this saying, you know, in 2 days, we're deleting all of your data. And you can, and they want to get paid at the end of the day. So they're often willing to work with you a little bit.
It seems so crazy that you could actually speak with someone. I've heard some of these recordings, actually, from people who've been hacked, where they call up and they record the conversation with the person. Why can't you track them down through that phone call?
That's a great question. Part of it depends on the technology that's being used for those phone calls. A lot of it is going to, again, come back to the international issues, right? Yeah. Most of those people are not going to be based in the United States, where it would be most straightforward to track a phone call, go find them, figure out who, you know, has the lease on that space. Presumably, by the way, the person you're speaking to on the phone is not the mastermind behind the organized crime ring. They're some, you know, lowly person who's being paid a very small wage by the organized crime to speak off of some customer support script. The way that, I mean, again, it's very similar to a lot of lawful enterprises in that regard, that you're not dealing with the head honcho most of the time. And because in order to usually both to get to the phone banks and to get to the people who are in charge, you're going to have to cross a lot of jurisdictions. You're going to have to get a lot of cooperation from international law enforcement. And you're going to have to be able to do much more than just figure out where did this phone call originate, which can itself sometimes be difficult. You're going to have to sort of connect all of the pieces back to who was paying this person, who was paying the phone bill. It can be a fairly long and difficult process.
You can join the conversation we're having with Josephine Wolf by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. You can also send a tweet to @KERAThink. So Josephine, why are hospitals or it seems like hospitals have been the focus of recent attacks so often?
So I think there are a couple things to say about that. One is that it's hard for hospitals to keep this secret. Mm. So one of the things we always have to keep in mind is we only know about the ransomware attacks that people tell us about. So it's possible that all over the place there are banks suffering these and just paying quietly and not mentioning it to anybody. And there are a lot of reasons why you might want to do that. Exactly. Hospitals tend to have, a fairly public presence. If operations are going to be interrupted, people tend to notice that. So there's often more of a sort of public element to those. It's also possible there are hospitals that have successfully kept it quiet. And I think the other thing about hospitals, though they're not unique in this regard, is that continued operations are really, really important. Right. You can't just say, everybody go home. We're going to figure this out. We're going to take some time. You really have to be able to keep seeing your patients and treating them. And therefore, you can apply a lot of pressure as the criminals. You can say, even if in the course of 2 days you figure out some way to restore the whole system through backups, do you have that time to waste? Is it really worth it to you to do that?
It's sort of sad because it's almost like the cyber criminals are literally attacking the weak duckling of the bunch, the hospital where they have sensitive health data that they can't risk being shared or they're worried about, and then they're being offline and lives are on the line. So it's the weakest point.
Oh, absolutely. There's nothing about these guys that's good. That they're very smart. They're good at what they do, but they're taking advantage of the fact that there are sick and dying people, and access to these systems is really crucial for being able to help them.
What do we know about who these cyber criminals of today are, the ones doing ransomware attacks, or where they are in the world?
Very little on the whole, very little that's sort of public knowledge about this. There have been some very small number of sort of high-profile takedowns around. There was a bot called Game Over Zeus that was used to distribute a ransomware program called CryptoLocker a few years ago. And that was sort of the last big success in tracking an investigation. That was being run, I want to say, by some folks in Russia. Hmm. And so there's definitely a sense that a lot of this is being run outside of the United States. And that's part of what makes it hard. I mean, most of the money, most of the victims are in the United States, we think. But that means that other countries don't necessarily have the same incentive to be investigating it, and contributes to the challenges of doing that.
Why Russia?
They're phenomenal cyber criminals there. I mean, they're not the only place. I don't mean to place all the blame on them.
Of course.
We don't know where everybody is, but they do have some. They do have a history of sort of very talented people. And to be honest, they're not the most cooperative with the U.S. government, that branch of law enforcement. So it's a good place to position yourself in some way. You don't want to place yourself in a country that you think is going to help the FBI do everything it wants in order to track you down. You want to be someplace where if the U.S. authorities are looking for you, you have a chance to evade them.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. This hour, we're talking with Josephine Wolf. Her latest piece in The Atlantic is called The New Economics of Cybercrime. You can call or email with your thoughts. The number is 800-933-5372. The email is think@kera.org. And, of course, you can also send a tweet to @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can customize your master's degree to help distinguish yourself in the workplace. You can still apply for fall with the expedited admissions process. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. Our guest this hour, Josephine Wolf, writes about ransomware and the new economics of cybercrime in The Atlantic. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Josephine, you write about something really strange that's happened because of ransomware, this idea of something called or termed the trustworthy criminal. What is that about?
So that's about the question of, if you are going to be paying to get access back to your own data, are you actually going to get it when you pay? And the difference between the so-called trustworthy criminals and untrustworthy criminals is that some of them aren't actually going to decrypt your data after you pay a ransom, and some of them are. And the reason it matters to them and to us is because if you don't actually get your data back, nobody's going to pay. This business model isn't going to work for them. So they have a huge vested interest in trying to build reputations for themselves so that when they target victims, those victims actually do go ahead and pay them.
So is there any sort of criminal ranking system like on Amazon or eBay where you rank how reliable a criminal is in this case?
Yes, exactly. Exactly like eBay, right? You can imagine a black marketplace in which you can rate people. And usually, again, this sort of goes back to a period when criminals are selling to other criminals and they want a sense of who they can trust. And so they can rate each other in a sort of more standard criminal-to-criminal way. And now what you see more, because you're dealing with people who are not criminals paying to them, you do a Google search and you find message boards where people write about this for given types of ransomware or programs that they've encountered. And that's a big part of deciding whether or not you're going to make this payment.
So I don't know. I'm sure you don't have statistics on this, but how often does it happen that individuals or a company or a bank pays whatever they've bargained the price down to get access to their data, to get this code, and doesn't get their data back?
I don't have statistics on that. My sense from talking to people about this is that it's relatively rare, but it's growing increasingly common. Because in the beginning, a couple years ago when ransomware was first emerging, it was being done mostly by a fairly advanced set of criminals. And then as it became clear that it was going to be hugely lucrative, a lot of less talented, less organized criminals joined the pool and, as some people say, ruined it for everybody else, ruined it for the trustworthy criminals by not giving people back their data, which made them all much more suspicious of paying anybody.
Let's go to the phones now. Let's speak with Sam, who's calling from Dallas. Hey, Sam.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment that if that were to happen on my computer and if I were hit by ransomware, what I would do is boot it to safe mode. This is on my Windows computer. I'm not an Apple person. But anyway, I would boot it to safe mode with networking and then run or download malware bytes. It's a well-known anti-malware software that works real well in the free version. And, of course, they offer a paid version, too. But I just wanted to throw that comment out there and see if you have had any experience with that software before.
Thanks, Sam.
So it's a great question. I would say, first of all, that the criminals are getting better and better at making it difficult to do things like reboot in safe mode. You do always have the option of completely wiping your machine and rebooting if you have an external backup of all your data, which everybody should have, if only for this reason. That is a possibility. It's much easier for individuals than for whole organizations because it's a much more straightforward process to reboot everything from scratch. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's no threat, because that really only works so long as the only problem is you have no access to your own data. If somebody is holding your data hostage and threatening to give it to your competitors, it doesn't matter if you have a whole other backup. So yes, it's good to have a sort of plan in place to say, if I lost all my data, if it was all encrypted, I would have something else to do. But I will say that many anti-malware programs are not going to be able to root out the really sophisticated ransomware by the time it's already on your machine.
What is law enforcement doing to fight cybercrime? And who, which law enforcement is it? Yeah.
So a lot of different branches of law enforcement are involved in this, from local police departments up through the FBI and international coalitions with other countries. I would say a couple different approaches that we've been seeing with varying levels of success. One is really trying to focus on the cryptocurrency exchanges, right? So if all of this is happening in Bitcoin, at some point, most people, most criminals are going to want to turn their Bitcoins into cash. And that happens at Bitcoin exchanges where, you know, like a regular currency exchange, you go in, you have some number of Bitcoins and they pay out in cash. And one of the ways that you can try to kind of mirror the tracking of money flows that happens prior to cryptocurrencies is by focusing on those points of exchange and seeing if somebody comes in with an enormous number of Bitcoins and changes them into money, then what can you learn about those people? And again, the international component of this makes it all much harder, right? It's easier to regulate Bitcoin exchanges in the United States if you're the FBI than it is all over the world.
What do law enforcement say about whether or not to pay the hacker?
That is a great question. And it's been a little bit back and forth over the years. There was a very sort of covered in the media incident about a year ago when an FBI special agent told some folks at a cybersecurity conference in Boston, a lot of the time we just recommend people pay the ransom. Mm. And since then, the FBI has really sort of dialed that back pretty dramatically. When I spoke to some agents for the article, what they said was, we do not condone paying the ransom. Because, of course, when you pay the ransom, that just encourages more of this type of crime. It contributes to the sense that it's very profitable, that people will continue to comply with your demands. On the other hand, the second half of that statement from the FBI is, we understand that there are real business needs and people sometimes have to do what is right for their business. So it's a sort of gray area, I would say, in terms of it's always going to be, in the short term, probably much more advantageous for you to pay and get back your data. But long term, for society at large, it just encourages more of this type of crime.
Ugh, that's a tricky question. Have you ever been hacked and had to decide what to do?
I've never, I should say, knock on wood, I've never been infected by ransomware. If I were, I would say I have multiple external hard drives with full backups of all my data, and I would probably wipe my whole computer and reboot from one of those.
Always good to ask someone who's writing about this what they do and then think about how I should have an external hard drive. And so
you should have an external hard drive. And I will say, just as a sort of small plug for that, a lot of people also have automated backups made by their computer, which is a great thing to do. But some of the newer ransomware programs actually directly target that. And so if your computer is automatically syncing to an online backup or something like that, some of these programs can actually go and find those and delete or encrypt them as well. So I think on top of that, always good to have a completely separate, not networked external backup.
How often do you update that?
Oh, about every 5 to 10 days, probably.
No, my gosh. You plug it in every 5 to 10 days and update it.
Yeah, it takes, it only takes a minute or two usually, unless I've been hugely productive in that.
All right. I guess something to, good advice there. I wonder, you talk about some of the ransomware and bargaining down the price, and I imagine that the role of negotiating could be important. I wonder if there's anyone who might hire a negotiator or someone else to do their bidding on behalf of their organization or their data.
There are certainly firms that sort of occupy an intermediary role in this space. A lot of the times you'll see them hired actually to purchase data back, even if you're not dealing with a ransomware program. If there's a company that suspects some of its information has been stolen and is being offered for sale, they may hire a firm to go out and look for that and purchase it on their behalf. I don't know if there are specific negotiating intermediaries. It's a little tricky because you usually don't have a lot of time. So you could, you know, try and find somebody. But often the way these programs are set up, they'll give you a day, maybe two, to decide, and then they'll threaten to delete all of your data. So I haven't heard of anybody hiring a third-party negotiator unless they sort of already have a security company that works for their firm and that is on call 24/7 for them.
Perhaps
it's probably not something you would see individuals doing.
Yeah. In the Atlantic article, you quote a few people who are making predictions about the future of hacking. What's in store?
I think we're going to see a lot more of criminals trying to get money directly from their victims. That is hugely beneficial for them for a number of reasons, one of which is just it means that there's a lot more data that's valuable than there was before, right? When they were only selling to other criminals, then they had to get certain kinds of data that were interesting to criminals. They had to get credit card numbers or social security numbers or something else. But there's a whole wealth of data out there. If you look at the contents of my hard drive, probably nobody in the criminal world is very interested in paying money for that. But it's valuable to me. Mm. So if you're able to sort of directly exploit those victims' wallets, then you're able to find a lot of data that you can steal that has value to that one particular person, to that one particular organization. So I think we're going to continue to see more of that. I do think, though, that it's possible if people and organizations get much better at backing things up than they currently are, that we're also going to see sort of variations on this model in which instead of just encrypting your data and leaving it on your hard drive, especially for firms, you're going to see their data being stolen, copied over to somebody else's server, and then you're going to see them basically being blackmailed and extorted, saying, you know, if you don't pay me for this data, I'm going to give it over to your competitor, I'm going to post it publicly on the internet. And that is even harder to defend against because then you don't have the option of saying, well, I don't care. I have a backup of it somewhere else.
And then you're paying someone to perhaps promise not to post it at that time, but you have to be continuously monitoring to see whether they would post it later and a competitor might find it then.
Exactly. It's definitely not – even when you're paying, I should say, ransoms for traditional ransomware, there is some evidence to suggest that as soon as you pay to get your data back, you are more likely to be struck again because the criminals have realized that you are somebody who cares about your data, who's willing to pay for it, who probably doesn't have a very stable backup system in place. And there's no sort of returning the stolen goods when we're talking about data, right? If you steal a piece of artwork for me and I buy it back from you, then I have it back. But if you steal my data, I'm not really buying the data back. I'm just buying your silence and hoping that it will last for a while before you decide to extort more money from me.
Why haven't we seen more mobile ransomware attacks?
That's an interesting question. I think a lot of the times the data that's stored on people's phones also exists in other places. So things like your email or, you know, we don't store usually like work files on phones that don't also exist on our home computers or somewhere else. So there's less of a fear that if all of the data were wiped off my phone, there would be no way to get it back. On top of which, you know, a lot of the phone manufacturers now make backing up to something like iCloud pretty standard and automatic. But it's possibly an area that's going to grow.
So I store a lot of my data in the cloud. And as you said, there's iCloud, there's Google Drive, there's lots of those types of services. What are they doing to protect our data?
Well, that's a question that it's hard to answer from a public perspective because they don't, for good reason, make a lot of that terribly public. I think there are a couple things that you probably see generally across the industry. One is keeping a lot of copies of data, right? Making sure that if something happens to one copy of your data, it's being mirrored in other places. Another is looking for anomalous patterns, right? Looking for something that's happening to your data that isn't usual, that wouldn't sort of be a normal activity, and trying to flag that and stop it before it's irreversible. So, right, if it's normal that every day at 10 o'clock, all of your data is synced up with your iCloud or Google Drive, then that will look like regular behavior to the company. But if it's not normal for at 4:25 p.m. all of your data to suddenly be encrypted with an encryption algorithm you've never seen before, maybe that's a trigger that you want to stop and sort of authenticate or take some extra steps before you go ahead and let that happen.
Interesting. It sounds like similar to what's happened with stolen credit card data over time, or monitoring people's purchases and making predictions about what's really them making a purchase and what's not.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of that sort of anomaly detection comes from the credit card fraud space.
So what is the most valuable type of data in terms of being able to sell it on the black market?
Right now, medical records seem to be pretty pricey, certainly worth more than payment card numbers, and probably because the data that's stored in your medical record isn't going to expire or be canceled in the same way that your credit card number could be.
Oh, that's interesting. And I saw also that passwords, I guess just generally, are pretty pretty profitable if you can get them.
Yes, it depends a little bit on what they're the passwords to. But
Though
often people reuse passwords, so even if I get your password to a relatively uninteresting site, sometimes it will turn out it's also your bank password or your email password.
Now, what is the ransomware Locky? You mention it in the piece, and I've heard of it before. How does that work?
I don't know the specifics of that program exactly. I think it's comparable to sort of some of the earlier crypto locker type models, in which you see them encrypting the contents of a hard drive, leaving it local, and then demanding a payment.
And that seems right now like it's the most popular form.
Definitely that's the most popular form. That's the one we're seeing the most that people are talking about publicly.
But it's funny because it seems like there are leading organized criminals and they come up with these funny names like Locky, or you've mentioned a few others. But how many are there? How many varieties?
There are a huge number of different ransomware programs. Usually there are a couple that are being spread by the really powerful bots, and the bots are kind of these infected computers that are harnessed to spew spam emails everywhere all the time, and those are the ones that are most profitable and infect the most people.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. This hour, we're talking with tech writer Josephine Wolf. Her latest piece in The Atlantic is called The New Economics of Cybercrime. She's an assistant professor of public policy and computing security at Rochester Institute of Technology. You can call or you can email with your thoughts. The number is 800-933-5372. And the email is think@kera.org. We'll be back with more in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like former student Dr. Candace Bledsoe, educator and community leader in diversity and inclusion. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. We're talking with tech writer Josephine Wolf. Her latest piece in The Atlantic is called The New Economics of Cybercrime. As always, you can join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. So, Josephine, are cyber criminals the only ones who should be held responsible for cybercrime?
That's a great question. With no easy answers, I think the answer is, in an ideal world, yes, probably. They are the bad guys. They are the ones who should be punished. But given how difficult it is to track them down across various jurisdictions, it's really becoming increasingly clear that the only way to make strides in this space is going to be to also hold some of the intermediary companies, the internet service providers, the software developers, the hardware manufacturers, at least partially accountable for implementing strong enough security measures to keep the criminals out.
Let's go through some of those and what role they might play. I'm thinking of Bitcoin, for example, and attempts to hold Bitcoin responsible for not just ransomware, but for cybercrime in general. What's happening with that?
Sure. So Bitcoin's a really interesting one because there's not really a centralized corporate entity for regulators to turn to with Bitcoin. The whole point is that it's this very decentralized currency. So if you want to crack down on intermediaries, you're really seeing a focus on those exchanges, the places where you can go and exchange Bitcoins for cash or for currency in a non-cryptocurrency form. And that's really crucial. If you're talking about regulatory interventions, you have to find some kind of organization that you can regulate. You can't just say I'm gonna regulate the blockchain, because that's a really impossible thing to enforce in many ways. So the intermediaries in that space that I would say are most likely to see increasing liability and responsibilities around this area will definitely be the exchanges.
Is there any insurance for cybercrime or for ransomware that people or companies can buy?
There is data breach insurance now. Many insurers at least offer a sort of basic data breach policy that, say, retailers often have. It's a very, very sort of nascent market in the sense that nobody knows exactly how they should be calculating the frequency of these attacks. Nobody knows exactly how they should be calculating the costs of these attacks. And on the whole, the organizations are desperate to buy more and more and more of it. And the insurers are very wary of selling too much because they're not entirely sure how to model the risks.
There's an email we got from someone named Scott. He asks, for the individual user, what about the strategy of checking mail and screening attachments on a less significant computer before saving?
That is a great strategy, right? If you're willing to read all your email and do all your web browsing on a computer that has no valuable data, then that will probably be a very effective screening method. On the other hand, it's much more time intensive than many people are willing to take, right? So to have a whole separate computer where you screen everything and then to go over the computer where you do all of your real work and check your email again is probably more time and attention than most people are willing to devote to security.
I guess, though, it would work for people who tend to use Chromebooks or for most of their work, perhaps browsing the web and checking their email and then have a computer that they might do more serious writing on or something like that.
Yeah, that's fair. If you have a device that you really, you know, only use for communicating with the outside world and it has none of your other data on it, then that could work.
Let's take a call now. Harold is on the line from McKinney. Hi, Harold.
Hello. We subscribe to software security suites like McAfee, which every time we go online, they're updated in order to keep our protection current. And supposedly, these software suites screen their emails and attachments to make sure that nothing gets through. How do these get through software suites like McAfee, and especially for a big institution which probably invests a lot more in security than I do?
Thanks for your question.
So the way that most antivirus programs like McAfee work is they keep a big database of what are called signatures of malware. So they have little snippets of code from the malware programs, and they tell your computer, if you see anything being downloaded with this code in it, then that's malware. Don't download it. Don't let it execute. The way that the criminals keep circumventing these is usually they purchase copies of them. So, you know, anybody can buy McAfee. You definitely want to have a copy on hand if you're trying to write a new ransomware program, and you tinker with that code signature. So you release a very closely related version that has a slightly different code signature that's just different enough that the McAfee database won't recognize it, won't match it with the previous version. And you release that and you wait for enough people to be infected and to report it and for McAfee to update their system database again. And then you go and you do the same thing over.
So it's quite a process.
Yes, there's a lot of back and forth, and there are a lot of very closely related versions of these that get released as the antivirus folks track them and find out what's in them.
What degree of, I guess, responsibility should individual internet users, such as myself or anyone else, have for accidentally opening or participating in cybercrime by opening, not checking, doing due diligence in checking attachments and so on?
That's a great question. And it's beyond just sort of the question of what your responsibility is to check attachments. It's quite possible that your computer is also part of the bot that's sending out these emails, spreading more ransomware if it's been infected. And even though you don't know anything about that and you certainly wouldn't want to contribute that, your machine may still be contributing to that overall endeavor. I would say in the place where we are now, probably the answer is very little individual liability, both because it would be so difficult to enforce in any meaningful way, and because there are so many people who are falling prey to these kinds of phishing emails and ransomware attacks that it doesn't really seem reasonable to be saying the folks who aren't careful enough are really negligent in this case. I think if we could get the technology to the point where you could really drive that number down, then you would be able to make a stronger case that there should be liability for failing to do certain basic security things in the same way that there might be for failing to fasten your seatbelt or failing to take safety precautions that everybody would agree are obviously common sense.
We got an email, a question from Tony. He asks or says the point was raised about how the criminals can convert huge amounts of Bitcoin currency to cash. He says, in order to do that, is there any evidence or suspicion that criminals are in collusion with governments to facilitate the currency conversions?
Not that I know of. There are certainly interviews I've seen where people say there are whole countries in Eastern Europe that are completely supporting their economies based on cybercrime. I have no sense of whether that's true or whether that's complete speculation and wild fantasy. I think there are a lot of different ways to be in collusion. Let me say that. I think that there are probably not a lot of governments that are directly funding themselves by operating ransomware operations. I think there are certainly governments out there that are not terribly eager to help the authorities in countries like the United States chase down the responsible parties. And that in itself could be considered a certain kind of cooperation with the criminals.
In your reporting, Josephine, how much time do you spend in the dark web or doing work that wouldn't be familiar to most of us?
Relatively little. It's a hard thing to do, and it's in some ways a risky thing to do. So I'm interested in sort of getting a feel for that space, but not in diving too far into it.
And is it risky in the sense that you could get infected with ransomware, or risky in what way?
That's a good question. I think, to my mind, it's risky in the sense that if it became clear I was there not as a criminal, it would draw a lot of unwanted attention from a lot of very smart people.
Yes, indeed. Let's take another call on the phone. Here is Daniel's calling from Dallas. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was just wondering whether it's nowadays, with how accessible things can be digitally, whether hard copies of things like bank statements and personal security would be safer in as hard copies instead of digital copies.
All right, going back in time, what do you think, Josephine?
You know, I think to a very limited degree, there's some value to that. If I had documents that I absolutely could not stand to lose, I would keep a hard copy. Right? You think about, say, property deeds; those are still done on paper. Those are still kept in a vault in physical form. And I think, you know, one of the things that I sort of took away from the Hollywood hospital that was infected by ransomware, that was able to go back and operate on paper, admitting papers and records, was that there's probably a little bit of value in keeping some of that around. That's not to say that not at all conceivable that we're going to move back to an age where everything is on paper. But for a small number of very high value documents, I don't think it's a totally stupid idea at all.
We've talked about a few of these ideas or tips for data protection. It was also called computer hygiene, which I think is just such a funny term. Are there any other tips besides the hard documents and the hard drive that you recommend to people?
I think one of the biggest things right now is being really, really paranoid about email, just because so much of this is happening through infected email attachments or links sent by email, that you almost can't be too paranoid when you're reading your email. And keeping in mind the fact that anybody in the whole world can send you an email from any from address, pretty much, and just because the name that appears is a recognizable name, or even just because the email address that appears in the from line is recognizable, really doesn't mean that it's coming from somebody you know. It's coming from the person that you think it is. And especially paranoia around attachments and links, I think, is very warranted. Even if you're pretty sure that it's from somebody you know, even if you're pretty sure you know what it is, if there's something funny going on with it, always better to be more cautious.
How effective do you think the spam filters are on things like Gmail or other email servers?
I think they're tremendously effective, but the problem is, even if they're catching 99.9% of the malicious emails, there are still going to be a small number that get through, and it only needs to happen once or twice to have a pretty devastating impact.
So there are a lot of myths about cybercrime. I was having fun looking through this list of myths about how people get infected with malware. What myths do you find yourself having to clear up?
Myths about malware.
Like, for example, that computers that are PCs are the only ones that get infected, or that if you don't open scary looking attachments, you'll never get infected, or I guess just misinformation about how people get attacked by ransomware.
So definitely, I think there's some misinformation about the susceptibility of Apple computers, as you say. There's more malware out there for Windows machines, but that's mostly just because there are more Windows machines out there. And so if you're a criminal and you're going for scale, then that's more efficient. But definitely there is Apple-targeted malware out there now and in growing amounts. I think there are a lot of misconceptions generally about computer technology. And I always think about my grandmother when I talk about this, and sort of that there are a large number of people who don't really understand where data is stored, what it means for data to be stored on a computer or on your email or somewhere else. And I think the idea that people can sort of reach in from the outside world and erase data, as basic as it seems to a lot of us, can actually be pretty startling. And a lot of the people who are being targeted by these scams, say, are, you know, from elderly populations, people who don't have a very deep technical background necessarily, and are really startled to learn that it's even possible for somebody to encrypt all of the data on your machine in a way that you can't get access to it.
Where should lessons about clean computer hygiene or data protection be taught? Should they be taught in schools? Where's the educational role come into play?
Gosh, everywhere. Yes, I think schools are a good place. On the other hand, I think that by and large, the younger population has, in many cases, more savvy about this than the older population in this country. And so I think workplaces are another really important area for thinking about training people in this regard. I think that senior citizen centers, there's a very, very vulnerable population of older people who do email and don't know a lot about how it works.
Josephine Wolf, thank you so much for speaking with me this hour.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Josephine's article for the July issue of The Atlantic is called The New Economics of Cybercrime. She's an assistant professor of public policy and computing security at Rochester Institute of Technology and a faculty associate at the Harvard Berkman Center for Internet and Society. You've been listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. She'll be back tomorrow. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Alan Roberts. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Help on the phones today from Elizabeth Myung. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can reach all of us via email, think@kera.org. Thanks so much for listening.